Support for this show comes from Mercury. There's an art to making the complex feel simple. Everything should be in sync so that even the smallest part serves a bigger purpose. Simplicity can transform your business operations. That's why Mercury powers your financial workflows from the bank account, so ambitious companies have the precision, control, and focus they need to perform at their best. Apply in minutes at mercury.com.
Hey, this is Scott Galloway, author, professor, entrepreneur, and most importantly, host of the Prop G podcast. We got a special series running on right now called The Future of Work, where I answer all your questions on, surprise, the future of work. Questions including, what are we missing when we work remotely? Or how do we handle work-life balance when a major opportunity comes knocking? From the provocative to the technical, we're offering insights you won't want to miss. So tune in to The Future of Work, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Canva. You can find it on the Prop G Pod wherever you get your podcasts.
Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia and arguably its most important policymaker, is known for doing kind of brazen, aggressive things. But it seems like he may have pushed the limits even more, according to some new information, literally hacking the phone of Jeff Bezos, the head of Amazon, who also owns the Washington Post, and using it to potentially blackmail him over Jamal Khashoggi, who he later just murdered. At least that's what we think happened. We're not really sure. But today on Worldly, part of the Vox Media Podcast Network, we're going to tease out what we know and what the broader implications of the story are, because they're absolutely massive. I'm here with Alex Ward. Jen is out today, but we have special guest Matt Iglesias here with us, who is both a Saudi and Amazon knower. Hello, Matt.
Hey, good to be here.
So, Alex, why don't we start with you? Because you've been diving into the technical aspects of this. I've been fascinated by it, from what I can tell. Let's not get too much into the weeds of, like, megabyte uploads and so on, but tell us why we think the Saudis did it and the basic TikTok of events here.
In early 2018, Mohammed bin Salman sends this WhatsApp message to Jeff Bezos. They had exchanged numbers, and it includes this video. And when Bezos clicks it, it installs this program, we think. And this program extracts data off of the phone without Bezos' knowledge. And so this is a pretty brazen hack here. Now, the timeline comes that this is before Saudi Arabia kills Jamal Khashoggi in October 2018. This is before anyone even knows about the Bezos affair, which we'll get into at some point. So after this hack happens, then all of a sudden information starts to leak out related to the Bezos affair. And after the Khashoggi, this campaign led by Saudi Arabia, it seems, to go after Bezos because of the Washington Post critical coverage. And so all this seems to come back to, there was this moment when Bezos and MBS shared numbers, this video came, and then all of a sudden Bezos starts to worry, hey, you know, I think the Saudis kind of hacked me. He asked for an independent audit, and it looks like, based on this audit and even the UN possibly looking into it, that the Saudis are responsible.
It's interesting that so many influential Americans seem to have been on, like, text messaging terms with Mohammed bin Salman to the point where this could even arise. He doesn't WhatsApp me all that much, which I guess in retrospect turns out to be a good thing.
Yeah, if you get a text message from someone claiming to be Mohammed bin Salman, do not under any circumstances click on any videos he sends you.
That's just a life
hack for Worldly listeners.
But what's weird is you would think the reason would be this is clearly somebody impersonating the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. That's the scam, but it's really him, and that's the scam, right? I mean, that's something that's a little bit odd. I think it raises a lot of questions, frankly, about, like, what MBS is up to and the interplay between him, the Trump administration, and Bezos and Amazon, which has been subject to a really sort of multifaceted criticisms from the Trump administration, which seem to be grounded in a desire to get the Washington Post to not write mean things about the president or mean things about Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, that's the thing that is so interesting about this is, as we've been talking about, and you may remember Jamal Khashoggi, who the Saudis, at this point, we can say 100% confidently, did murder at MBS's direction, was not just bothering them in the way that, like, any critical coverage would. It seems to have, like, radically incensed the Crown Prince personally for reasons I don't fully understand. It almost feels, as you're suggesting, Matt, Trump-like in its sensitivity to criticism.
Wait, like, why couldn't they just brush this off? Like, lots of people over the years have, like, written the take that the Saudi government is bad.
Right. Like, all of us in this room at one point have written bad things about the Saudi government.
We haven't gotten a text.
Yeah, no, I've gotten no texts. I've gotten no.
I'm not going into any Saudi consulates in foreign countries.
No, that's true. I'm definitely not doing that. But I have been to the Saudi embassy in DC and, like, yelled at the Saudi foreign minister in person about the war in Yemen. And, like, they don't care, right? They still send me emails and like, interact with me. It's not. The degree of anger towards Jamal Khashoggi and his work that motivated not only the murder, which turned out to be a massive PR disaster for the Saudis, but also apparently to personally burn their relationship with the head of one of the world's most influential companies by doing this kind of exploit thing. It's baffling to me. I do not understand.
But they do seem to have mostly pulled it off, right? I mean, it was a PR disaster. But at the end of the day, right, the reports are that after 1 year of staying away, like, everybody is back to, like, the Saudi Investment Forum. Everybody wants a piece of the Aramco IPO. And the general principle that, human rights and democracy and other things people often purport to care about don't count if it comes to sort of Persian Gulf oil monarchies. Like, those rules seem to be back in effect, more or less.
Well, so my sense of it is that there's been especially since Khashoggi, a serious turn in the Democratic Party against the U.S.-Saudi alliance.
That's
really
true.
Dates back to the Obama administration, right? Like, if you talk to Ben Rhodes, who is Obama's, like, big foreign policy advisor, he's been saying for years that the Saudis are bad and we need to move away from the Saudis. Like, that's one of his favorite things to say if you talk to him. And I just think that has become a much more mainstream view among the Democratic foreign policy establishment since Khashoggi, and especially since MBS and Kushner have gotten so close. They are in a constant WhatsApp communication, apparently, which makes me wonder, like, did Jared Kushner click on any telecommunications promotional videos
Probably.
That happened to contain malware?
Boris Johnson, too.
Yeah, that's right. They're also on texting terms. Yeah. Like, it's just mind-boggling to me that the Saudis they've compromised everybody's phones.
Yeah, it could be blackmailing Kushner. I mean, there is a certain irony in that information security procedures were heavily debated in the 2016 election and do not seem to be something. It turns out that Republicans are not quite as fanatical on this subject as some of their rhetoric about Hillary Clinton may have suggested. There's been no indication that we're going to have a congressional investigation into whether Jared is following all the best routines and procedures in this regard.
But as WhatsApp messages, I think I should take a quick step back and explain why. You know, we're talking pretty confidently that it's the Saudis. We should probably explain why it looks that way. So, one, it's MBS's phone number. that's an important thing. Two, if you look at the UN report, which we'll link in the show notes, the evidence we have is really circumstantial, but it basically starts with, you know, Jamal Khashoggi criticizes Trump. And, of course, we go all the way to the murder. And then it goes to the phone number exchange and then all the kind of weird things. And so it just looks like, you know, between the number and that's part of it. Also, the technology used, I won't go too into this, but the capability, like, not everyone has the ability to just send a video and extract tons of data off of a phone. That is an exquisite capability that only a few spyware or surveillanceware, however you want to say it, companies can provide. And the Saudis have bought this capability. We know this. We know that they've bought it from certain companies. And one of the leading theories is that the Saudis bought the capability of a program called Pegasus from an Israeli spyware company called the NSO Group. The Israelis and Saudis, despite all their public, rebuffing of each other, are actually doing a lot of business in private. Now, I'm going to say very clearly here, this is a theory only. It is alleged. No one has officially pointed fingers at the NSO Group, although the UN makes pretty clear in their report that they think it's the NSO Group. But I reached out to the company, and they have told me, no uncertain terms, our products are only used to investigate terror and serious crime. Any suggestion that NSO is involved is defamatory, and the company will take legal counsel to address this. So we're not saying it was the NSO Group. We're saying that the UN report mentions it, and there are a lot of cyber experts who believe that the program that it has called Pegasus, which is, again, very exquisite, goes into the phone, you click on the link, and just starts extracting video. Many cyber experts believe a program like that was used on Bezos.
So, dear Israeli, not government, but also not government spies, if you want to sue somebody, sue the UN, not us.
Correct.
Is basically what we're saying.
Yes.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, a lot of technical experts have been dumping on the report that Bezos got to try to prove or try to figure out who it was and then prove that it was the Saudis, that it just, like, wasn't very well done. But there is one part of the report, which is not so much technical, but I think is, like, the 100% funniest part of this entire saga, which is that later on in the process of trying to figure out what happened, Bezos has a meeting with some cybersecurity people to talk about why it is probably the Saudis. And then, like, a few days later, he gets a WhatsApp message from MBS that says, "Don't believe everything that you hear. We, the Saudis, love Amazon and want to do business with you." Something like that. That's a paraphrase. Yeah. But there's no way that he would have known that Bezos had gotten this briefing if he hadn't had access to Bezos's phone and his calendar and been exfiltrating data from it. And this is the single best piece of proof in the entire report that the Saudis did it. And it's 100% because MBS is an idiot and directly texted the information he couldn't have had.
Unless there are Saudi spies inside of Amazon. That's
all. Either way.
Yeah.
One thing, this is a kind of disturbing story on its own terms. Although, you know, what's nice about all the Bezos Amazon, at least politics stories of the past couple of years, is that we hear about them in part because they all cast Bezos as a good guy, more or less. Like, he is not changing the Washington Post's editorial line in order to win the JEDI contract for Amazon Cloud Services. He is not canceling his columnist because someone is threatening to ruin his marriage by sending photos to the National Enquirer. It's, of course, very possible that there are other influential business people in the United States of America who are succumbing to the kinds of pressure that have been brought to bear on Bezos and Amazon. It would be a little bit odd if, like, this was the only influential business figure who has been leaned on by the Trump administration and he blew them off. And so then they just, like, never tried again. Like, that's not usually how things work in the world. And it's a very, I think, one of the biggest sort of, like, known unknowns that is out here is, like, what else is going on in the intersection between government, media, business, these international dimensions to these kinds of things. Because, like, it would be really bad if the Washington Post, like a major newspaper, was to just, like, start running articles that are like, Saudi Arabia is amazing and Trump is a very stable genius. And then they could all, like, get nice contracts.
Yeah, I mean, it creates, like, a really interesting question of how you think about security and the intersection of national security and, like, sort of business security. Amazon is this massively important company. And if you have the ability to suborn Jeff Bezos, you have the ability to get access to vital personal data on billions of people worldwide, including if you're an authoritarian state, Saudi Arabia. Right, like there are Saudis who use Amazon Web Services, et cetera, all sorts of different things that could allow you to have compromising information on people. And all of that could come from suborning the person at the top. And so to Matt's point, right, if Amazon is a company where this didn't work, imagine even if it wasn't Mark Zuckerberg, someone at Facebook who succumbs to this kind of pressure, or I don't know, like insert social media company here, Twitter, for example, where so much political discourse takes place. There are all these points of vulnerability for the United States created by tech monopolies, and that are run by private people who can be privately attacked by state enterprises. And also, one thing to note here, the Saudis are known to be bad at this stuff. There's a good piece in Slate about this that's suggesting that what MBS did here is evidence of the weakness of Saudi cyber capabilities relative to other state actors.
Certainly that follow-up text suggests a certain weaknesses in their operational practice.
Yeah, and so like, what about China, which, as far as I'm aware, is probably second to the United States in terms of these kind of capabilities, maybe even surpassing it, depending on who you talk to, right? Like, there are so many different ways to use these technologies to get at people. I'm not sure we understand, like, the scope of the problem that this case illustrates.
Well, I want to make clear, when we talk about, like, states that can compete with the U.S. on cybersecurity, it's really kind of only four. It would be China, Russia, North Korea, Iran. If I say compete, not like that they're better. I mean, China is arguably better, but that they have the ability to mess with us online. And of course, our elections, as we know in the Russia case. But when we're talking about like this Bezos hack, what we're really talking about is a specific target. According to one report, like let's say, allegedly, if it was Pegasus that was used, that program from the Israeli company NSO, like it's a roughly $25,000 a pop for one license to use this. Uh-huh. An individual, an amateur, could fork up that money to get this license, but then they would have to know, you know, actually how to target the person, and you would really want to have to do it, right? So this is why it seems like a country would use it, and the fact that if Saudi Arabia did buy a program like that, which many experts are saying is likely, it would show that, one, they don't have the domestic capability to use it, and it would show that this was incredibly, of course, premeditated, or that at least they wanted to buy these kinds of capabilities to go after people. And the Saudis do it not just to Bezos, but to dissidents and to activists and all other kinds of people that the kingdom feels is a threat to the royal family or the style of governance. And in Bezos' case, it looks like it's because Jamal Khashoggi worked at the paper that Bezos owns,
mm-hmm.
and of course was, you know, allowing good coverage of what was happening, CIA reporting that MBS was involved or behind it, you know, what happened when Khashoggi went to that Istanbul consulate. And so in this case, it seems and there was also like a Saudi troll farm, which seems almost directed by the regime itself, because they were all going after Bezos saying, you know, ban Amazon, boycott, you know, Bezos, et cetera, et cetera. And then it kind of like stopped all of a sudden, which implied that it was state driven, that it wasn't sort of organic. And so all this to say is that like, yes, the hack by itself is brazen, and the capability used is quite impressive, but it really speaks to this broader notion that Saudi Arabia is looking really hard at going after all kinds of dissidents, anyone that can make it look bad, even if it's arguably the world's richest person.
And, you know, an interesting thing here is, Alex, you know, you were talking about sort of countries the United States' adversarial relationships with, Iran, North Korea, you know, China was friendlier but competitive.
Frenemy, in the words of Tom Steyer.
Exactly. relationship. You know, what's interesting is that Israel and Saudi Arabia, not alone among countries, but these are countries that, you know, formally speaking, are allies of the United States, close relationships, but also are increasingly involved in partisan politics domestically, right? I mean, Bibi Netanyahu, I think, made no secret of his preference.
No, he's just a Republican. He is a Republican.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a different kind of relationship from the U.S. and Israel are allies to Israel is an ally of the Republican Party in the United States, right? And it becomes sort of reflexive. Democrats have become more critical of the U.S.-Saudi relationship, which in turn encourages the Saudis to be more involved specifically in U.S. domestic politics. And there are hints of that in the sort of Ukraine stuff that has led to Trump's impeachment, right? But countries sort of conducting American domestic politics as part of their foreign policy, as opposed to a sort of, you know, like abstract state-to-state relationship.
Yeah, it is certainly interesting to contemplate what the Saudis are going to do in the 2020 election, right, if they're willing to do this kind of stuff to Bezos. Like, we can't know what's going on right now, but it's very clear that they have everything they want from this administration. They have a very, very close relationship with, if not the head of state directly, then his son-in-law, who is like, does everything, as far as I can tell, for the current administration in ways that are quite disturbing to contemplate, given his lack of qualifications. They really love the Iran hawkery of the Trump administration. They find that they have a staunch ally who's willing to back them, even to the point of vetoing congressional restrictions on the war in Yemen, which is obviously Saudi-run and a project designed to counter Iran's influence as part of Saudi's general paranoia about rising Iranian power. You'd think, again, given those incentives and given the push in the Democratic Party we've been discussing, that they would feel like they have an incentive to do even more to meddle in American politics, not less, in the upcoming year.
Well, meddle in American politics to me is strong. It's not like they have the ability of the disinformation campaign that Iran can wage, that Russia can wage, to a certain extent China and North Korea can wage. To me, meddle, I mean, yeah, they could say we like the Trump administration, we're friendly. I just don't see how I don't see how that's going to win that many votes. I don't see like how they could actually exert that much pressure over Iowa or New Hampshire voters.
What if they send a text message to an important Democrat that has a video that they click on and then exposes their
affair? MBS.
I don't think it would be meddling on that level, right? It's that, you know, the Gulf states have a lot of connections to the national security community in the United States of America, right? So U.S. defense contractors sell a lot of stuff to Saudi Arabia. They also, U.S. defense contractors, have on their payrolls a lot of retired flag officers, right? Many of those people appear on cable television in the United States as national security experts while also being dual-hatted as sort of paid influence peddlers for, you know, aspects of the military-industrial complex. And it was something you really saw. This was not per se partisan politics, but after Soleimani was killed, right, people would come on TV as analysts and be like, yeah, you know, like, we got to get him. And then, like, crank leftists at The Intercept would be like, all these guys are cashing checks from the companies that make these missiles and things like that. But you're like, you know, you're not supposed to talk about that. And so, you know, particularly if you imagine Bernie Sanders, who's very anti-Saudi, right, and has left-wing positions that, you know, like, lots of people are just going to disagree with on the merits, there's going to be hard to sort of draw a firm line between what's people saying, like, this guy is too left-wing for my taste, and what's people with financial interests in play, and including ties to the Saudis, to the UAE, sort of throwing their clout around to say, like, oh, no, you know, we're going to be at risk here, particularly because in my experience, sort of national security professionals in the United States don't do a great job of being totally clear about the distinction between the physical security of Americans and the United States of America and sort of America's regional policy in the Persian Gulf, which has a lot to do with the Saudi alliance and not a lot to do with what regular people actually care about.
I have a lot of thoughts on that. And we're going to come back to them after a quick break. Enjoy, and we'll be discussing not only sort of the general politics of this, but also a theory I have about whether or not hacking Bezos was actually a smart move on Saudi Arabia's part.
Support for this show comes from Mercury. Financial operations are needlessly complex. Startups have to cobble together a patchwork of tools to reconcile transactions from different sources and struggle to glean answers from platforms that speak different languages. Simplicity can transform your business operations. That's why Mercury powers your financial workflows from the bank account, so you can pay bills faster, stay in control of company spending, and speed up reconciliation. Apply in minutes at mercury.com and join over 100,000 ambitious startups that trust Mercury, not just for banking and credit cards, but for the precision, control, and focus they need to transform their financial workflows and perform at their best. Mercury. The art of simplified finances. Apply in minutes at mercury.com. Mercury is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services provided by Choice Financial Group and Evolve Bank and Trust. Members FDIC.
Hold up.
Hey, this is Scott Galloway, author, professor, entrepreneur, and most importantly, host of the Prop G podcast. We got a special series running on right now called The Future of Work, where I answer all your questions on, surprise, the future of work. Questions including, what are we missing when we work remotely? Or how do we handle work-life balance when a major opportunity comes knocking? From the provocative to the technical, we're offering insights you won't want to miss. So tune in to The Future of Work, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Canva. You can find it on the Prop G Pod wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back, worldly listeners. We are talking about Saudi Arabia's hack of Amazon head Jeff Bezos. I'm sorry, alleged hack, even though we have very, very, very good reason to believe that they did it. We just, you know, got to put that alleged in there. But look, here's something we've been sort of dancing around, but I want to state boldly and see what the two of you think. I think that this was stupid, right? I don't think that it made sense for Saudi Arabia to use its crown prince to try to extract information from the head of one of America's most important companies. And my reason for thinking this is that it is too brazen and unsophisticated to have, like, yielded gains relative to the PR costs. And it's not obvious to me, based on what we know publicly at least, that the Saudis got anything out of this. Like, they attempted to blackmail Jeff Bezos about his affair, it seems like, anyway. We're not clear from the text and the information. They texted a picture, MBS texted a picture of a woman that kind of looked like the woman that Bezos was having an affair with, but, like, not really.
I think that was blown way out of proportion.
I think so, too.
Way out of proportion.
So, like, and now there's a theory that they leaked the affair to the National Enquirer, but why would they do that if they want to blackmail somebody? Like, something about their whole behavior here doesn't make any sense to me, especially since they wanted to just kill Jamal Khashoggi, the employee that they were so angry about. And if they were just going to kill him, why also hack Bezos and make him even angrier? Like, this seems poorly thought out to me as a strategy.
The Wall Street Journal reported effectively, and we'll link it in the show notes, is that the Saudis wanted to surveil Bezos but not blackmail him. Which I think makes more sense just based on what you just laid out. I think they wanted to make, you know, see what he was thinking, especially with the whole Khashoggi thing and his own affair, et cetera, et cetera. They wanted to get eyes on Bezos. I guess I don't see, like, I can see why, at least in the logic of the Saudi royalty of MBS, they would want that. But I agree with you. This is totally going to backfire. I mean, there's already, politically, I don't see much difference because Democrats are already going to be anti-Saudi. There's going to be more anti-Saudi. And Republicans, although more quietly now, are starting to have their reservations. You know, Saudi Arabia kind of, as Matt alluded to, kind of got over the whole Khashoggi thing. And there were still a lot of, you know, financial ties to Saudi. There were still a lot of Silicon Valley ties to Saudi. But now that it's like, oh, we could hack even Bezos' phone, I just don't see how they really come back from that. Like, I don't see how you are a rising Silicon Valley company, you know, who wants to attract Saudi money, sure, but now you have to think twice, thinking maybe they might just start hacking us, surveilling us, see how they're doing, you know, see how we're doing with their money, et cetera. So I just don't see how this works in the long run.
Well, and when MBS was first installed as crown prince, right, he did a sort of publicity tour in the United States. It seems like he spent some good money on hiring some good people. He got a lot of favorable stories placed.
He's a reformer.
Yeah. I mean, he did walking tours of these Silicon Valley companies, and the impression you were clearly supposed to get, right, was like, all right, the dice of a weird monarchy, like, came up in a favorable way. Everything that you maybe feel a little icky about in the U.S.-Saudi relationship is about to get better. This guy gets it. You know, he's a friend of America, a friend of American business, but he also sees the problems and he's moving to address them. Everything that's happened over the past year really just undercuts that, right? I mean, it's not just it undercuts the idea that he's a reformer. It undercuts the idea that American elites should feel good about him being in power. It makes him seem immature, impulsive, like he goes too far, like he makes sloppy decisions. Basically, what you worry about in a monarchical system, right, which is that, like, the next generation heir could just be an idiot, right? And there's nothing you could do about it. And that's what he seems like now, right? Like, he's too close to Jared Kushner, right? Donald Trump is, like, not going to be president until the end times. He's not cultivating a relationship that broadly makes American stakeholders want to say, this guy's solid. Like, this guy makes good choices. We can count on him as the anchor of our regional policy. He's hacking businessmen's phones for obscure reasons. He's, like, maybe mixed up with the National Enquirer. He's killing people for no reason. And I think that's, you know, killing Khashoggi, it is a turning point in that Saudi Arabia has always had a sort of repressive system at home, but has not been seen as like exporting authoritarianism or like doing crazy stuff. Right? To take somebody who's just, he's just sitting in America, right? He's writing columns that are like, this isn't good. And now we're going to murder him, right? It is not, on the one hand, he's like, okay, it's just one guy, who cares? But it's a real crossing of a line. And it doesn't appear to have had any clear motive. Like, why was this so threatening to them? Like, why is it a big deal that they're lashing out like this?
Yeah, it doesn't, that never made any sense to me either. And sort of, you can say this not just about the way that he treats the West, but his policy more broadly when it comes to the region, right? Like, MBS has done two things that I think have really strongly undermined Saudi Arabia's international position and reputation, setting apart Khashoggi and Bezos, right? First is the war in Yemen, which was launched basically by him personally. It's his initiative back when he was Minister of Defense before he became Crown Prince. And that war has yielded relatively few tangible gains for Saudi Arabia in terms of diminishing any kind of threat to the kingdom. It has bogged them down in an expensive and bloody conflict in a neighbor and has only pushed the Houthi rebels closer. That's the rebel faction they're fighting, to Iran. Initially, they weren't that close. Now they rely on Iranian support for military success. And it has made a lot of people inside the United States furious, right? Like, I alluded earlier to a congressional vote against the war in Yemen. But if you think about that, right, there were enough votes on both sides of the aisle for a bill to pass ending American participation or support for this conflict that Trump had to veto it, right? That is a really, really stinging rebuke to the Saudis. And that's because the war has been really, really bloody. And the way that the Saudis have fought it has been very, very unconcerned and perhaps actively hostile to the laws of war in certain instances, like bombing hospitals and stuff like that. And then you have that on top of that, MBS has done a series of things at home that have been just obviously repressive, right? Like when he threw a bunch of people related to him in jail at, what was it, the Ritz-Carlton?
Yeah, it was a very swanky hotel.
Yeah, he home arrested a bunch of them.
In a five-star, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it was weird to imprison them like that, but it was generally part of a crackdown on quote-unquote corruption,
right?
That was in actuality a way of purging the royal family of political threats to him. He's been more repressive towards dissidents at home. And all in all, this has built this reputation of Saudi Arabia as not the, like, slick PR version that MBS tried to sell, where he's being less repressive when it comes to things like women's rights, like granting them the ability to drive and stuff like that, which is what we thought he was going to try to push. And the version of it you still get in certain influential columnists' writings on the topic. But just a country that has been more bloody, militarily adventurous, and repressive than it ever has been in the past. And that is pushing Washington sentiment further and further away from them. The Saudis can't afford to lose their American patron. I don't understand his overall strategic vision. I just don't get it.
I don't either, but I guess if you are MBS and you are not thinking the long term, I guess you could imagine that you're getting the green light from the Trump administration. I mean, you're close to Kushner. The president is vetoing anti-Yemen war laws, and didn't really do anything about Khashoggi at all. In fact, said, well, they're buying stuff from us, so we're good. I mean, I guess if you're MBS, you're like, the risk of, you know, Bezos finding out that it's us, and even if they do, like, the risk is low that Trump is going to do anything about it and change the Saudi relationship. So I'm not saying that this is not a Trump story in any way, but
it's kind of a Trump story
in the sense that, like, this green light to Riyadh has allowed MBS and to think like I can do a lot. I can do whatever I want, and going after Bezos is part of that.
It also reminds me of Trump's behavior when you were on the weeds and we were talking about Iran and Soleimani.
Yeah.
Is this tendency sort of comparable to the moving of the embassy to Jerusalem, where it's like people had been warning? I mean, I'm just stealing your point. People have been saying there's a lot of downside risk to this. There's a lot of downside risk to this, and Trump's view was like, probably nothing bad will happen. And he did it, and nothing bad did happen, right?
In the grand scheme of things, yes, right. Nothing bad happened.
And it's the same thing, right? So, like, the Saudis have been getting away with this stuff, right? But it's each of these moves is associated with a lot of potential downside risk and no really obvious upsides, right? And that's the problem for their strategy. In particular, I mean, they are greatly increasing the salience of anti-Saudi sentiment in American politics, right? This has never been a, like, super popular idea with the mass public. But also, like, who cares, right? But when you're doing things like you're killing journalists, you're hacking super famous business people, you're, like, massacring people in Yemen, right? They are, like, ratcheting up the level of scrutiny that this relationship gets. And then they're banking on the fact that Trump is in their corner to, like, take care of all their problems. But 5 years ago, I would have said, you know, the U.S.-Saudi relationship is totally outside the scope of partisan politics. And now, because they, I think, overreacted to Obama's mild skepticism, have turned it into a much more sharply contested issue for no good reason.
Yeah, the Iran deal was a turning point.
Right.
Let's just make note of that. The Iran deal was a turning point. The Saudis felt that the U.S. was getting a lot closer to Iran. Then the Saudis started to lash out in the ways that we've discussed in part. And then, of course, Democrats thought the Iran deal was good. Trump pulls out of the Iran deal. Then that helped to politicize this as well as the Yemen war. But I do kind of wonder, you know, even if a Democrat's in power, the way, you know, if a Democrat wins this next election, they're going to find a more hostile Iran, maybe an Iran that's closer, not close, but closer to a nuclear weapon. It will be harder, I think, for even a Democrat that may be Saudi skeptical to be friendlier to Iran. And they will need something to balance it, and it's going to be Saudi Arabia. So I think even if you're thinking sort of like in long-term risk, that's a way to kind of hedge. If you're in Riyadh, you're probably thinking maybe down the line they're going to need us unless somehow there's this miracle turnaround with Tehran.
One thing I think that is telling of the sort of unsophistication that we've been talking about in the Saudi strategy is the connection to the National Enquirer here, which we haven't like sort of not discussed very much, but it seems likely now that this is the vector through which, this being the Saudi hack, is the vector through which the National Enquirer got the news about Bezos's affair with this woman, Lauren Sanchez?
Yeah. So you don't think it's the brother?
I mean, that again, according, I'm just going by the UN report here.
Right? Yeah.
The UN strongly suggests that that is what happens in its timeline of the things. Can't assert any kind of special knowledge or theory.
Because law enforcement is looking into the allegation that her brother is the one that leaked this information.
To the National Enquirer,
yeah. Which to me makes a lot more sense
than
the Saudis did it.
It's sort of, I mean, the only thing that I think raises the plausibility of the Saudis is that the Saudis and the Enquirer had this close relationship related to the MBS publicity rollout, which mostly consisted of things you would expect, right? Like getting a favorable Tom Friedman column, getting a friendly 60 Minutes segment, because those are like highbrow media. But they also had all these like National Enquirer special issues.
Yeah.
We're like, why does the Saudi government care about the National Enquirer's audience?
I don't know. I mean, maybe they know that the president cares about the National Enquirer, or at least has praised it before, right? Like there was one tweet where Trump favorably compared them to, I believe it was the Washington Post, actually, in terms of their coverage.
Well, and Trump has a long-time close relationship, right? So one of the allegations is that the Enquirer would habitually pay people who, you know, like buy the story of people who had scandalous information on Trump, but then not run it, right? So it's a catch and kill instead of doing the normal sort of tabloid expose stuff. Anyway, it's not totally clear. It seems possible.
Yeah, and that may not be this story. I think, Alex, you're right that the brother is a more like sort of you can understand the logic behind it. But I also can't understand the logic behind the Saudi decision to hack Bezos in the first place. And they have the whole idea of there being a Saudi relationship with the National Enquirer is strange for the reasons that Matt just suggested. Like, why cultivate this source? What do you get out of, you know, appealing to somebody who's like leafing through something in a supermarket and then thinking, oh, maybe the Saudis are okay. Like, they're not going to vote on the basis of the U.S.-Saudi alliance or criticism of Saudi Arabia from someone like that, right? It just speaks to, I think, a lack of understanding on the Saudi part of domestic American politics, or more broadly, one might say, how their actions play and their behavior operates in the context of mass democratic politics, right? It's often the case that policymakers in places like the United States don't have a great handle on how internal politics work in authoritarian regimes. But that goes the other way too, right? Authoritarian governments don't understand exactly what sways public sentiment, how publics operate in democracies. In fact, a lot of policymakers in democracies don't understand that stuff, right? It's quite difficult. And so it wouldn't surprise me if a lot of the Saudi actions here are explained by a poorly informed theory of how to cultivate political support in a democracy.
But I also would say, I think short-termism is clearly the culprit here. I mean, I think, you know, MBS is like, I got Trump, we're good, I can continue to do this. And then just looking through history, like, the U.S.-Saudi relationship has been rocky, but we've been pretty fairly consistent with ups and downs since FDR, right? So one could assume, like, looking at recent modern history, that if you're in Riyadh, you're thinking, well, yeah, maybe this might cause some problems once it's revealed, if it is. But, like, we'll get through it. It'll be fine. And Democrats, they might gripe now, but maybe they're just going after Trump and using us as to do so in a way. And then they'll come back to us, or at least they know they'll have to work with us down the line. I would assume that's the bet, because it's been a pretty consistent bet by the Saudis that they've just been with America for so long. And, you know, Khashoggi, Yemen, Bezos hack, and yet I don't think any of us are saying the death of the U.S.-Saudi relationship is imminent, even with a Democrat in power.
And they must feel also that they're having drawn closer to Israel over, you know, not super recently, but it's a relatively recent development, and that has shored up their political standing in the United States. It used to be a tension point in U.S. domestic politics that the Israelis used to oppose big weapon sales to the Gulf monarchies that they thought might be used against them, hypothetically. Now the Israelis see that as an anti-Iranian measure that they support. So, you know, I can see where that gives them a sense of confidence. I think what they maybe misperceive is that it also creates a sort of vulnerability, because it is much more convenient for people who are skeptical of America's regional posture to complain about Saudi influence than to complain about Israeli influence. And so the putting of those two states in alignment in some ways sets the Saudis up to be the fall guys for critics in a way that they hadn't been before.
It is certainly more difficult to challenge the U.S.-Israel alliance than the U.S.-Saudi alliance in American domestic politics.
I mean, one of them has a strong base of support from, like, actual Americans. Like, non-elite Americans have strongly pro-Israel sentiments, not everybody, but many people. Whereas there's no, like, constituency for the U.S.-Saudi relationship as firm and well-entrenched as it's been. Like, you wouldn't— It's a bad look for politicians to be, like, out there, like, we love these guys.
So I think that's where we're going to leave you on this general note of uncertainty about the future of one of America's longest-standing alliances in the Middle East. I want to thank our engineer, Malachi Brodus, our producer, Jackson Bierfeldt, and I want to thank Matt, the host of The Weeds and Vox Senior Correspondent, for coming on our show. Woo. We always love when he shows up. And we will encourage you, as per usual, to rate and subscribe and review Worldly wherever you get your podcast. And we'll see all of you next week.
Support for this show comes from Mercury. There's an art to making the complex feel simple. Everything should be in sync so that even the smallest part serves a bigger purpose. Simplicity can transform your business operations. That's why Mercury powers your financial workflows from the bank account, so ambitious companies have the precision, control, and focus they need to perform at their best. Apply in minutes at mercury.com.
Hey, this is Scott Galloway, author, professor, entrepreneur, and most importantly, host of the Prop G podcast. We got a special series running on right now called The Future of Work, where I answer all your questions on, surprise, the future of work. Questions including, what are we missing when we work remotely? Or how do we handle work-life balance when a major opportunity comes knocking? From the provocative to the technical, we're offering insights you won't want to miss. So tune in to The Future of Work, a Prop G Pod special sponsored by Canva. You can find it on the Prop G Pod wherever you get your podcasts.